Welcome to The Grange Point, where we hang out and talk about the latest news in science technology and how they relate to your everyday life. This podcast is brought to you by the Young Scientists of Australia. We're a youth organisation aged 15 to 25 whose work is to promote science to the youth of Australia.
On this week's episode, we have Lauren.
Yo!
Kim.
Howdy.
And Justin.
We celebrate our favourite time of year, and that is the Ig Nobel Prize award season. And that is the award that is given out for outstanding work in an area of science where no one really thought to ask a question or really ever really wanted to know until now. So we celebrate some fantastic new work in the fields of Ig Nobel Prizes.
This week's City of Science is the wonderful city of Cambridge in Massachusetts, in the United States of America. Now, you might be wondering why we're talking about the second best Cambridge, and there's a good reason for it. We're actually talking about Cambridge because it is home of Harvard University, one of the world's most prestigious universities, specifically one of the most prestigious ones in the United States. And we're talking about it for a special event that was hosted there that recognizes some of the less prestigious, less glamorous, less amazing, but yet important research that is undertaken by scientists slaving away at their microscopes, at their titration units, and at their telescopes to figure out some of the deepest mysteries of the universe. And this is, of course, recognized through an award, an achievement, to recognize them as pioneers in their field. I mean, this prize is admired by many and is tightly fought year in, year out for the past over 23 years. And that is, of course, the Ig Nobel Prize. Now, the Ig Nobel Prize is a parody of the very, very famous Nobel Prize. And it started off as an idea by a publication called The Annals of Improbable Research. And it sort of became an ongoing thing, which they turned into a massive award ceremony and night. And has been running since 1991 and has awarded many hilarious, yet interesting and insightful scientific awards. We've talked about this in the past on The Grange Point. Specifically last year, we talked about some fantastic ideas that they brought up. And this and the award ceremony was recently held last week. So we're going to be talking about it this week, to discussing some of the research winners, some of the research losers, and some of the fantastic yet hilarious work that's been going on here for the Ig Nobel Prizes. This week's City of Science is Cambridge in Massachusetts. The Nobel Prize has a lot of very prestigious different categories, for example, economics, literature, peace, physics, chemistry, medicine, biology, but no mathematics, of course. So what categories does the Ig Nobel Prize actually have?
So for the Ig Nobel Prize, we have a couple of them that are very similar to the Nobel Prize. We've got physics, psychology, we've also got things like public health, neuroscience, biology, art, medicine, Arctic science, and nutrition.
This is a pretty broad range of categories. I mean, much wider and much more inclusive than the Nobel Prize, which I guess is pretty nice.
It does mean that, like, a lot more research gets considered for it, and a lot more scientists get recognized for an amazing work, which I think is really, really cool.
Yeah, so let's talk about some of these interesting and fascinating stories. Let's start off with psychology. So I note here that the interesting part about the psychology research was it was answering a question that we've all wondered late at night while scrolling through Facebook and taking selfies in a myriad of different locations and then tweeting about it to all our friends. But what has that got to do with psychology and Ig Nobel Prizes, Lauren?
So the winner for the Nobel... So the winner for the Ig Nobel Prize was actually this year Peter Jonasson from the University of Western Sydney with his colleagues. So his question was actually to do with the dark triad set of personality traits. So things like narcissism, psychopathy, and, you know, manipulativism.
Right, so I don't think that's a word, Lauren.
I think I can make up that word because I am actually
a psychology major.
Yes, definitely that.
Ah, well, so, I defer to your qualifications.
I do like how they actually call it the Dark Triad. I mean, it's just like they're sitting here, okay, we need to name like the character flaws thing for a fantasy thing. We need like to give them a debuff for their character set. Okay, it's fine. They get the debuff feature, the Dark Triad. Oh man, that's amazing. Okay. Just imagine like Dungeons & Dragons character sheets including this as a skill.
Well, the interesting thing is I think why they called it the Dark Triad was first because it's all like these dark, you know, the types of personality traits you expect from like a dark character in a game. And also because these personality traits are actually shown on average to be more present in people who spend lots of time up late than those who habitually wake up early in the morning.
Oh, right. Night elves. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, night elves are dark elves, so that makes sense that they're evil. I mean, that's just a well-established fact in fantasy lore. So how exactly did they find out that these mysterious dark elves, night owls, were actually more evil because they possessed the Dark Triad character traits, Lauren?
So what they actually did was they gathered a whole bunch of participants and then split them up according to whether they spent all their nights up at late trolling the internet forums or whether they, you know, got a nice early rest and then woke up early in the morning ready to face the day. And they tested each group's for those specific traits. So narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism. So they tested each of those participants for each of those traits using specific tests. And what they actually found was they found a correlation between the people who stayed up late at night and those characteristics compared to there wasn't that much of a correlation between people who got early night sleep and woke up early and those traits.
It's sort of suggesting that the person who gets up early and not only do they get the worm, early bird get the worm, but they also get to be nicer people because they're bathed in light and joy, whereas the night abiding night owls are much more gloomy and dark, and literally gloomy and dark.
Well, isn't the shadows the best place to undertake your evil doings?
That makes complete sense. I guess if you're going to be a more manipulative and narcissistic person, you're going to like those circumstances better. I just find it really interesting to actually manage to find a correlation in those things. Now, this obviously is not saying that these people who like being up at late have these traits. It's sort of going the other way. It's saying the people who have these traits also like that being up late at night.
Well, I suppose if you have to interact with people every day, then you're going to be a bit nicer than a person who spends most of their activity late at night. It might be just an exposure thing.
Certainly could be. And I really find that's actually a really fascinating piece of research. And that was done at the University of Western Sydney. So it's a local study. So go us being represented. And it was done by several authors, as Lauren mentioned at the start. And they're working for the School of Social Sciences and Psychology at the University of Western Sydney in New South Wales. So congratulations, guys, on winning that Ig Nobel Prize and representing Australia in why people with the Dark Triad of characteristic traits tend to often also be night owls.
Oh, so, Justin, have you ever stepped on banana peel?
Actually, I have, and it's quite funny because it's really surprisingly dangerous.
Yeah,
it's seriously worrying.
So you stepped on it, your feet went out from under you, and you fell right on your bottom, just like in the cartoons. Now, does that actually happen?
Well, in my case, it wasn't so much that it actually happened in complete cartoon head-over-heels manner. I kind of just slid awkwardly for like half a meter and it like went it kind of into the splits and it hurt. So that was just weird. I was more concerned about my ankle at that point rather than falling face first into the ground. But it is a staple of the fantastic slapstick vaudevillian comedy, the slipping on a banana peel. And everyone has wondered about this for years, and obviously many people have anecdotal stories, like myself, of what has happened to them when they have slipped on some unfortunately misplaced fruit. But not to be satisfied with anecdotal evidence, some scientists from Kitasato University in Minato, Japan, actually put this to the test. They could not let it purely be conjecture or anecdotes. They had to find out for real just how slick a banana peel really is. And a shout out to all our Japanese listeners, and we do have several. This story is done from some fantastic researchers in Japan, and though we may be mocking this concept, we are not mocking their research methods and integrity of their study, because as you will find out, they seriously tested this out and got to some amazing results.
So they found unfunny science from funny science.
Exactly. So what they did, and this study was led by Kiyoshi Mabuchi. So Mabuchi-san and his colleagues, they sacrificed 12 Cavendish bananas, the iconic and seductively slippery banana found in grocery stores worldwide. And what they did was they placed these bananas, removed the delicious banana interior and flesh, and placed them interior side down on samples of linoid, right? So they tried different sections of each banana peel. So they actually not only used the same type of arrangement, but they also tried placing different parts of the banana peel onto the ground in different ways. And what they placed it onto was linoleum, or lino, as we call it in Australia, because we like to add O's to the end of things, and which is basically some sort of vinyl polycarbonate flooring covering. So generally not the stickiest thing, but also can be quite slippery in times. Something you can definitely slide in your socks on. So they placed underneath the sample of lino several force transducers. So basically they measured the force, weight, and pressure applied to each object.
Okay, so Justin, how did they actually, like, test for the slipperiness then? Like, how did they figure that out? What type of tests did they use?
What sort of unit do you use for slippery? Is it units of banana, units of peel?
Well, that would be a pretty great System International Mark II version of the measurement here would be to use units of banana peel. Because we can now answer that as a figure. The concept of measuring something's slipperiness is actually really, really important for everyday life, for everything from cars to your clothing to gloves and shoes. And that concept is, of course, friction. And we measure the slipperiness of an object, or rather the lack there of the slipperiness, with the coefficient of friction. So the coefficient of friction is basically the measure of how much resistance something faces when in contact with another surface. And each property has its own unique coefficient of friction. And the coefficient of friction, it has to be said, it's not just for one item, because it takes two to tango, so to speak. You actually have to have the coefficient between two items to actually compare. So what is how much force does it take to actually slip between them? And that's effectively what they're measuring. And there's a couple of really funny ways where you can do this, including like putting an object on its weight on a slab, knowing its weight, and then tilting it to see what weight it has to get to drop. And from that, you can actually figure out the coefficient of friction. So you can play this game at home if you really wanted to. But they were doing this in a much more elaborate way. So they took these banana peels. And what they did was they actually took it one step further. They just didn't want to know the static coefficient of friction. They wanted to know the coefficient of friction when it was underneath a force. Say, like if someone was stepping on it, which may, of course, cause the profile to change, the surface area, contact area to change, or might become squishier. So they had to, of course, thoroughly investigate all the forces. So what they found is that bananas are indeed incredibly slippery. The average coefficient of friction, so between a banana and lino, was about 0.066. And between a banana and hardwood floor is 0.083. So they found that lino is much slipperier than hardwood floor. Now, to keep this in comparison, because it's kind of hard to say, well, Justin, what does that mean? The coefficient of friction for Teflon, which is the non-stick frying pan surface that you might be familiar with.
One of the slipperiest substances imaginable.
Yeah, or ice, are around 0.04 and 0.05. So the friction of a banana on lino was 0.06. So that's pretty close in the order of magnitude to ice and Teflon, which is incredible when you think about it. By comparison, rubber, which is pretty sticky, sliding on concrete, which is really coarse, has a coefficient of friction of around 1.02. So, wow, okay, what we found out here is that bananas are really, really slippery, almost as slippery as Teflon and ice.
So you're saying if I want to cook my eggs, I should cook a banana in the fry pan first?
No, you cook it on the banana. And it won't stick to it.
So why is it the bananas are so slippery then? I mean, we've established that they're slippery, but why are they slippery?
Well, that was a really interesting question. And yet again, the researchers led by Mabuchi-san have really answered this question even more thoroughly than you could possibly have imagined. They tested bananas, but what about other kinds of fruit? You can't just measure one thing. You don't really know much about everything else in that case. So they examined apple peels of various thickness, citron peels, tangerine peels, and a whole bunch of other fruit. And what they and not just like one sample size, but they tried different sizes of the different fruit skins as well. So 3 meter thick sections of apple peels became slippery came in a slippery second, and its coefficient of friction was around 0.1. So double, basically almost double that of Teflon and banana peels. And tangerine peels, or mandarin peels, for those in Australia, was a similar type of fruit. Their skin was really actually quite coarse, but it came in at about 0.225. So again, about four times more than the coefficient of friction of Teflon, ice, and banana peels. So it's actually really fascinating that banana is just so much slipperier than even the other fruits that we know about.
So what you're saying is that cartoons are right and I should watch more vaudeville shows for more science.
Well, that's right. And we could also learn a lot more about fruit and improving a healthy diet. Mabuchi-san said that the 12 bananas, they did make it to the final paper, but he also started eating many more bananas. So he was starting to eat them, but then he realized it was way too much for him to possibly consume. So he had to start distributing to his students. The fascinating end part of this is what actually makes them so fantastically slippy. And one of the reasons is that when they looked underneath a microscope, they observed that the banana peel produces a gel-like substance, which is they're hypothesizing is the source of the slippy results. Mabuchi-san is actually a biomechanics researcher, so he's not just a guy who specializes in bananas. He's a very serious realm of study. And the reason why he's investigating this is perhaps if they can get this gel and figure out a way to make it work and produce in other ways, then maybe able to do this in artificial joints and have a naturally producing lubricant that we can produce under force that reduces the friction between artificial limbs and bone and cartilage, which could make artificial limbs, elbows, arms, and hips much more durable and comfortable. So this is some fantastic work being done from the Kitasato University in Minato, Japan, and our hats do go off to them, as well as our comedic sense of timing.
This has been the Young Scientists of Australia's podcast, Lagrange Point.
This week we heard about the history of the Ig Nobel Prizes, plus discussed the winners in their field of psychology, as well as looking at some fantastic physics research around slipping on banana peels. Tune in next week for more Ig Nobel Prizes.
Our ending theme was composed by Audionautics. Head to ysa.org.au for more information about the Young Scientists of Australia.